So good morning, all. We want to welcome you to the Mornings with Joel CRE podcast. We have a very special guest with us today, Daryl Carter, who is an absolute legend in the multifamily space, but he's kind of a gentle giant. So if you don't know him, don't be surprised, but let me tell you, you will, because he's a true player in the commercial space. You know, one of those guys that you say, no, he's for real. So, you know, you'll appreciate what he has to share with us today. So Daryl, how you doing, man? Good to see you again.
I am great. It is fantastic to be here. It's great to see you. We've all been sort of in our hibernating corners over the last few years, and it looks like we're starting to get back out. And it's delighted to see you, Joel. I've listened to a number of your podcasts, and you do an amazing job. So keep up the great work.
Oh, man. Well, thank you very much. I didn't know you were one of our listeners, so I really appreciate that. Yeah. Fantastic. So, Daryl, obviously, we've known each other for a while, but for the sake of our audience, you know, you're not an upstart to the multifamily space. And what was interesting is, well, just tell us a little bit of your background, you know, where you're from, how you get to Southern California, and why real estate? You know, what really kind of led you down this path?
Well, I like to think, you know, I tell people, they say, wow, you're successful. I said, yeah, I'm an overnight sensation. I've been doing it for 41 years. by way of background, I grew up in Detroit. I went to school at the University of Michigan. I played basketball there. And then I later went to graduate school at MIT. And then my first job I took in Chicago, working at Continental Illinois Bank, which eventually became B of A, you know, and worked 10 years in kind of corporate world. And then in 1992, started a company with a longtime friend and still a longtime friend, Quentin Primo. And we started Capri Capital. Quentin and I went to high school in Detroit.
Now that I didn't know.
Yes, we were Cass Tech High School. So we started Capri and really to create an investment firm that targeted underserved markets. And we had an equity business and a debt business. And, you know, we built those, you know, that platform up to be almost $8 billion of assets under management from 1991 to 2005. And then we sold our debt business. We were a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA lender. Mm-hmm. We sold that to an affiliate of the related companies. And I continued to run that. And then eventually at that point, you know, Quentin and I, who remained great friends, we kind of wanted some different things. So we ended up separating at that point. And Quentin took the equity business. And then I later, 2-3 years later, started the company that I have now, Avanath Capital Management, with some of the ex-Capri team on the West Coast. So, you know, and I would say that my premise for most of my investment business is, you know, when I grew up in Detroit and I saw the transition to the from the 60s to the 70s, it was a function of disinvestment where people stopped investing. And I had a premise that if you start investing in some of these underserved markets, you can have a positive turnaround. And so that was that's really been the thesis, you know, very simply with both businesses that I built, that if you make the right investments in underserved communities, you can move the needle in a significant way. And so I started Avanath in 2008, and we've built about a $4 billion apartment portfolio, primarily in the affordable housing sector. We operate about 16,000 units that we own in various partnerships with institutional investors, and then we manage another 3,000-4,000 units as we have a partnership with another company in North Carolina, which is a Black-owned firm, Laurel Street, if Dion Nelson, my great partner. And so, you know, we operate almost 20,000 apartment units, which comprise probably 50,000 of people, and most in Black and brown communities.
All right.
So that's my story.
Yeah. You're sticking to it, right? So, no, that sounds good. I tell you what was interesting to me is, you know, at one point, Quentin Primo's star was really glowing, if you will. And I was asking him, I was like, where do you get that name from? Capri. And come to find out, it was a mixture of
Carter and Primo.
And Primo. I was like, how about that?
I wish I could be more original. My current company name, Avana, if it comes from my daughter, Ava, and my son, Nathan. So I that's the best I got.
I got you. Well, you know, that was always in the back of my mind, too. I was like, where you get that name from? Because it's a little hard to pronounce sometimes. But yeah. Definitely stands out as unique. So that's interesting.
Well, my kids are, they're very close in age. They're about 18 months apart, and they have an amazing rivalry all the time. And she likes to point out that her full name is in the company. He likes to point out that he has more letters. So.
All right. Well, we'll let them have that fight. Oh, boy. Well, let me ask you this. Just kind of going back a little bit, you mentioned about when you left Capri and you sold off the debt business. But 07, I mean, you and I both remember that period of time. 07 was when the sky started falling, you know, from that standpoint. And obviously, 09, things really got ugly in 08. Why in the world did you think that was the right time to start a business? Was it just because of the sale of the other business? You were cash, you know, liquid, or was it just some other reason? Because it sounds crazy with the sky falling that you would go out and start another business.
Well, a couple of things. One is that I felt that the way affordable housing in the U.S. was operated, that there was a better mousetrap. So I felt that regardless of any cycle. But, you know, I did get involved in a very large potential acquisition, and not potential. It was an acquisition we did when I launched Avanath in 2008, we acquired a company that had a GP interest that in about over 20,000 apartments, and I put $30 million of equity in it. We borrowed a bridge loan of $300 million that I personally guaranteed some of it. Hmm. And it was a one-year bridge loan. So part of life, and that closed May 1st, 2008. Hmm. And it was due April 30th. That's why I know there are 30 days in April, because I could have used one more day. But anyway, it did not have a great end. I lost $30 million of equity investing in that transaction. And so my company, that was our first deal. We were off to a pretty bad start. I mean, but, you know, in many things, I think that situation helped shape the knowledge base of what it was a very expensive tuition. I learned a lot about in the affordable business, you can't over leverage, which most people do. Mm-hmm. And that the bottom line operations were tantamount and generating cash flow. And most people and most investors who have been primarily tax credit oriented have never demanded that cash flow. People focus on fees and tax benefits. And I felt that you could build a business where you could get operating cash flow out of affordable assets, which we have proven. So, you know, at the end of the day, and I didn't realize it was going to be, if I'd known it was going to be that much of a down market, I wouldn't have started then. I would have waited 2 years later. So it's just not as if, but, you know, it's interesting. We started Capri in 1991, which was not a particularly good year. It was all the RTC 9/11. Liquidity. Yeah. So it was all that. So, you know, down markets, which I think we're about to hit one, I think it's the best time to launch new endeavors. I mean, when you think about it, if you're in a market where there is great, people are having success, why, you know, the incumbents in a particular sector are going to dominate. You're not going to have someone new kind of emerge. And I remember in the early 90s when Quentin and I were raising money at Capri, part of what we'd say, whatever investment dollars you have, we're going to focus exclusively on our portfolio with you because we have no portfolio issues. Mm-hmm. We didn't need to say we really don't have any other portfolio. but at the time we didn't have any portfolio issues that most investment firms had at that time. So sometimes being new and having no negative is better than being big and established and having, you know, negative things. Or at least that was the spin we put on it, which is actually true.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. You know, that, you know, being able to realize that you don't have other clients and, you know, to say per se. And so you're able to focus on those and kind of build from there. But you bring up a very interesting point, because it takes a degree of fortitude to be able to say, okay, things are getting off to a rocky start. The economy's going crazy. You know, I mentioned 9/11. That was an error, because actually in 91, it was the RTC issue. It wasn't 9/11. That was about 10 years later. But
right.
But still, you know, being able to fight through that adversity and those challenges in the market and continue on takes a bit of a gut check. Why do you think you've been able to do that and be successful in pushing through? I mean, is there some secret sauce, or just, you know, you don't know when to give up?
Well, I think it's a lot of things. I mean, you grew up in humble beginnings. My dad was an auto worker, and you know, I just always, we did not have very much, but I didn't know that. But, you know, I think that the, in good markets, bad markets, there's ability to, you know, things work. I mean, one of the things that, that, you know, with our, my acquisition team, probably the average tenure is probably 15 years, maybe. So most of my acquisition team members have only seen an interest rate environment in the low twos.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I know, because I look at them when I tell them that my first mortgage loan that I got in 1983 was at 13.5%. And they look at me and I know they're thinking, wow, he was really a bad credit. That was subprime. But I mean, but it wasn't. Where interest rates were.
Yeah.
But one day I was just hearing, well, my God, rates have gone up. And I went and did a chart from 1981, which was my first year, to look at the average treasury rate from 1981 to today. And mm-hmm. the fascinating thing is that only 20% of the time that I've been in business has rates been lower than where they are now. We're still at a relative historic low, but it doesn't seem like that, because rates to go from in the twos to five seems like, you know, but I mean, the first 15 years of my career, rates were double digits,
mm-hmm.
you know, and people talk about, well, they don't want to see, they don't want to have negative leverage. And because we've had, you know, where you borrow and you get positive leverage, if you're buying at a four cap and you have, your debt rates are three, it works.
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, maybe cap rates are going to be 4.5 to 5 in apartments, and you're borrowing over five.
Mm-hmm.
But we had periods of time when we were getting 8-9% returns and we're borrowing at 12, and we just figured out have to get the cash flow up to that level. So mm-hmm. operations become a lot more crucial. And again, it's a matter of perspective. When you look right. at historic times, we are still have relatively low interest rates.
Yeah, it is absolutely relative in all sense of the imagination, you know, as it relates to that. But like you said, it's all relative. People look at it and they're, you know, think the sky is falling, but it's really not. It's just going back to more so what's normal. So definitely want to mention that. Now, I did want to pivot into something else, because I thought this was interesting, and I'm going to pick at you a little bit, but you're there in Newport Beach, fabulous, one of the wealthiest parts of the country. And your focus is not on people that basically live in your area. You focused on the inner city and the other areas. And what's so interesting about it to me is that there was a mantra of you could do well doing good. You know, me and Kirk Sykes have talked about it. You've talked about it. Quinn's talked about it. We've all talked about it, right? And the question is, who's really going to do it? Who's going to step up and make that happen and prove the model true? And one reason I wanted to have you on is because you've absolutely proven that model. You know, so how tough was it in the early days when people were saying, I don't want to invest in Southern California and Watts and those areas. I don't want to invest in Harlem. I don't want to invest in Detroit. Those areas are horrible. And you're saying, no, that's where we do want to put our money. You know, how did that all work out? Because that seemed like a tough mountain to climb.
Well, you touched on something that I rarely talked about. I just have to say one thing relative to, I spend a lot of time in Detroit these days. We're developing a project. I'll get into that later. But
okay.
I spend a lot of times, and every time I go to Detroit, I always go to my own neighborhood and I see my aunt, you know. And I always find when I come back home, it is like being in two different countries, just as an aside. But, you know, getting back to, we had a period of time and, you know, and there's been a lot of focus on investment equity and things like that. And, you know, back in the early 90s, you know, and after the whole Rodney King thing in LA, a lot of institutional investors, and, you know, Quentin and I, we were in the early days of Capri. But then there was my good friend, Victor McFarlane, who had started his company 2 or 3 years earlier. There was my good friend, Richmond McCoy, mm-hmm. who started a few years after us. And one of the things that we all came together to do is to convince some of the big pension funds, and one of which was CalPERS, and all three of us did business with CalPERS, was to convince them not about that you should invest in these communities because it's the right thing to do. But at the time, there was this huge thing about emerging markets and investing in the Brazil and other places like that and seeking, you know, very attractive returns. Mm-hmm. And what we came together and really spent time with the trustees and elected officials to explain that people in South Central LA, they shop. They need retail centers. People mm-hmm. there have disposable income. They need apartments and houses and things like that. But convincing institutional investors that there is a viable economic engine in many communities that are underserved by capital. And so mm-hmm. less, you know, really focused on the business opportunity and many of the things that we had to counter. And I'm not a retail expert by any means. But, you know, you would look and say a suburban shopping center, which has 5 spaces per 1,000 square feet. You go to, you know, a place in a grocery store in an older urban community that may be African-American, and all of a sudden it has 2.5 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet. Institutional investors, and I don't think it's redlining, but they're saying that doesn't meet our investment criteria because mm-hmm. we like to see 5-to-1. And what we had to convince them is, look, it's very high density area. A lot of people walk. A lot of people take public transportation and mm-hmm. people, they manage it. It's still the sales per square foot is very, very high. Sure. But many times institutional standards, which evolve from the newest properties, dictate the standard. And then, you know, and not to say there isn't red line for racial reasons and the other, mm-hmm. but I was convinced that more the issue were the institutional standards that evolved and then showing, putting our real estate hats on and really walking through why it could work at that level. And again, we stayed away from, you know, it's a Black neighborhood, you should just do it. But we said, no, there's a hell of a business case. You can make money. And there's lots, you know, and there's a need for nice grocery stores and things like that and housing and communities of color. And mm-hmm. and still to this day, you know, our investment thesis is about the investment need and the ability to deploy capital safely and generate attractive market returns.
Yeah, yeah. Because at the end of the day, it should all be about the numbers. You know, one thing that came up a lot was, you know, the majority of the people that work for the city where that money's coming from, like say CalPERS that are state workers and whatnot, all the people living in these inner cities.
Yes.
And yet still their money is being invested outside in suburbia. That really doesn't make a lot of sense either, you know, from that standpoint. Yeah. So I don't know if that came up a lot in your discussions, but it's, you know, something that I know is, as I've heard floated around from time to time.
Well, you know, the investment world, it's still, you know, it's still challenging. People have a lot of myths. You know, you say mm-hmm. something like Section 8 housing and people say, oh my God, don't want any of that. I mean, 40% of our doors are our households are Section 8 voucher holders. And then what I say, and people have perceptions, but, you know, our payment default in our Section 8 portfolio is less than 10 basis points. And I mean, you know, I am a big data person and we use data to support our investment thesis. And you can't argue with that. I mean, the industry standard in apartments is typically, and pre-COVID, I think it's higher today, is that the rental default rate is probably between 50 and 150 basis points. Ours is about 30 basis points. So, I mean, numbers don't lie, but there's still a lot of stigmas. you know, I remember having, and I've told this story many times, but I had an investor who was going to look at one of our properties in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is, you know, outside of Dulles Airport, probably the most, maybe one or the first or second most affluent market that we're in. And, you know, and it's an affordable property, but just to give a sense, the area median income where rents are pegged to are about $120,000 a year. So 60% of that, people were making $70,000. And these are people who are working out in the tech corridor in Dulles. And so the investment officer of a very large public pension fund was flying in and was going to go look at our property. Called me the night before and said, "Is there any possibility that I'm going to get shot if I show up at your property tomorrow?" And my response was, "Well, I don't know your personal situation. I don't know who you owe money to, whether you have an angry mistress or an angry ex-wife." I said, "Notwithstanding your personal situation, I said, when you go to our property tomorrow at 10 o'clock, it's going to be empty because everybody works. But the perception is that it's affordable housing and yeah. you know, and the demographic of that was, I mean, the funny thing is all of our properties, whether it's Hispanic, white, black, Asian, whatever the ethnic group, our properties are comprised of people who work very, very hard to pursue the American dream, and they're focused on advancing their families and the like. And so that's what affordable housing looks like. But there are perceptions maybe stemming from, you know, housing projects and urban areas and the perceptions, which are just don't match reality. And so a lot of what we do is educating investors as to what it is and what it means. And the fact that you come to our properties during the day, it's empty because people work.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. I was just thinking of a similar situation. We're modeling a property right now that we're considering acquiring. It is an affordable play. What's interesting about it is when I was first asking about it, the realtor said, "Well, did you ever see the TV show The Wire?" And I was like, "Dude, come on, man. It ain't that bad." You know, because but that's the perception.
It is the perception.
Yeah. And I drove the property as nothing like that. But again, you know, to your point, when they're coming from affluent suburbia, you know, that's the mindset.
You know, what has been transformative to us, Joel, is we started about 7 or 8 years ago, and it's been the fuel of our growth, is raising capital outside the U.S. And specifically, we've been focused on 4 countries, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Germany, and the U.K. And one of the reasons why that has been fascinating, and number one, we've had traction, and now about 45% of our capital comes from those, you know, from institutions in those markets. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, I've learned the housing models of places like Germany. And when you describe Section 8 housing to a German investor, they say, "Oh, we have that here, and mm-hmm. it's a good thing." I mean, somehow one of the problems we have with housing in the U.S. is that there are a lot of other factors, one of which is race, that yeah. just gets involved in the mix there, and it really shouldn't be.
Right.
You know, I mean, mm-hmm. the fact is that most housing in rental housing in places like Germany are mixed income, and you don't know who's getting a subsidy, but some mm-hmm. people there, you know, it's varying levels of subsidy. And, you know, but matters of race and all this other stuff just doesn't go into the housing business as it does in the U.S.
Yeah,
and that's what
yeah.
we need to change.
Yeah. Well, that's a powerful point, because they really didn't have those countries didn't grow the way the United States grew, you know, on the back of a slave culture and whatnot. It was totally different. So that's a valid point. Let me ask this. You mentioned about 40% of your revenue pretty much comes from Section 8. Do you model that when you go out to acquire a property, or is that just kind of an added bonus to allow you to juice your returns once you get into the property?
Part of it is that, you know, 85% of what we own is some rent regulated affordable property. It was either built with tax credits. Some we have that have local affordability, like New York rent stabilized properties, or state affordable programs or project-based Section 8, where it's actually all Section 8. And so there's an infrastructure in the affordable housing world that starts with HUD, and then it goes to state agencies. We're in 15 states, and they're state housing finance agencies. And two that we're very involved with are Florida and California. They're, you know, two markets we're in. And we develop very good relationships with those agencies. And then there's a series of public housing authorities, you know, Sacramento, Chicago, the housing authority of the city of LA. I mean, so we develop a relationship with them. And so we've become, they administer the affordable housing. They generally administer the Section 8 program. So we're very welcoming to housing vouchers. And so they are delighted, you know, with the relationship that we built and that we accept Section 8 vouchers. And we found them to be very, very good partners. We also try to be a good steward of taking care of those residents and creating, you know, quality environments for them to live in. So those relationships becomes really important. And we've learned that the state housing, I mean, the city housing authorities that administer the Section 8 program, you know, we have great relationships with them. We always are open to trying new pilots with them. I mean, probably the best thing that happened with COVID is that many housing authorities who used to insist on physical inspections for their properties will now do electronic, where, you know, someone walks the property with in FaceTimes and things like that. But we've been able to do far more online rentals post-COVID than we did before, and mainly because the house, we've worked with the housing authorities to monitor, to improve process and procedures. So, you know, Section 8, we've really built our company around the affordable world. Section 8 is a big part of it. I have 15 people that are in our compliance area that knows every different, you know, nuance of the Section 8 program and different types of vouchers and the inspections and all the other audits. So, you know, we've really built around that sector. And a lot of landlords, they view it as they don't want it. But I will tell you this, the worst month of collections we had during COVID was 98%. And part of that was the durability of the Section 8 portfolio, because there were enhancements made immediately to shore any economic losses of Section 8 recipients. So in other words, when that was in the first bill that passed. So if we had a Section 8 resident that had suffered an economic loss, it was easy for us to redo their status, and then Section 8 would make a bigger payment. So some owners got into it after they realized the durability of it, but it's a key part of our business. And we think that the residents who are Section 8 recipients, they're all hardworking people pursuing the American dream. And we continue to do things to support and elevate that resident base.
Gotcha. So would you actually put that in your pro forma, that you're expecting like a certain percentage of the development?
Well, we primarily acquire and rehab. So very often we will have a tenant base in place that will have a number of Section 8 residents. And, you know, again, we're always open to the local housing authorities, you know, to have voucher residents. And, you know, I could think of Chicago, where we have a great relationship with the housing authority there. We have a building that actually was a redevelopment out of the Cabrini Green neighborhood, where we have market rate residents and we have public housing residents that the CHA provides us. And people say, well, how does that work? And I said, it works very well. You know why? You give everybody the same apartment. Everybody has the same. Everybody gets the same apartment, and you treat everybody with the same level of respect, and you provide high quality customer service to everyone. So that's why it works. And whenever you start doing, you know, what's that in New York, the poor doors and things, and that's a disaster. But yeah, that, you know, so we're adept at doing mixed income housing and with people at different lower, you know, income levels.
Right, right. Now, one thing I did want to touch on, you mentioned that you were going to talk about a development in Detroit. And usually individuals that are in the space that you're in don't develop. You know, I know the reasons why for the most part, but I wanted to ask you about that because you said your whole model pretty much has been acquiring and rehabbing. Why would you look at a development deal now? I'm sure it has to do with basis, but I'll let you tell us about that.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one, I mean, it's interesting. The city of Detroit in 1960 had about a million seven people. It was the fifth largest city in the country. And today it has about 700,000 people. So a million people left. And I guess I was one of them. You know, so there's a lot of vacant land in the city. And I do think that, you know, when after the bankruptcy, and I've never not, because of relatives, family, University of Michigan, I always had my eye on Detroit, and I'd always go back and, is it time? Should I invest in it? And I think in the recent years, I've been impressed with the way the city has turned around and the opportunities. I mean, one of which, you know, Quicken has a big presence. There have been other industries, but the big industry in Detroit is automobiles, of course. But one of the things that is happening there, a lot of the Googles and Apples, who, you know, you heard 4 or 5 years ago about driverless cars, and they're coming. Well, what most of these companies, including Tesla, they now realize that the expertise in putting a car on the road is in Detroit. So yeah. All of them have partnerships. I think Ford has one with Google, but there are a lot of people moving into that community that are knowledge-based workers. And so we felt very bullish about maybe it's a time to invest. And, you know, we have a relationship with the mayor and who is very encouraging. And there's because the footprint of the city was so big, there's a lot of city-owned land. Mm-hmm. So we are developing with a very good friend who you may know, Ron McDonald, RMC Development. Yeah, well, Ron's my partner. Ron is from Detroit as well. Mm-hmm. And we always like to say we speak Detroit. And so Ron is my partner, and we are developing a 200 apartments. We started down this path in 2018. We expected that we would have been fully leased by now, but we haven't broken ground. And that's just because of COVID and some other factors, but we're still very bullish on the property. I mean, that's the challenge with development. We started that in 2018, and we've acquired over $2 billion of properties since then.
No, wow.
And I still haven't broke. No. You know, nationally, we've acquired over $2.5 billion worth of properties since we started on that project, and we still haven't broken ground yet, but we expect to do that this year. But, you know, we felt that, you know, part of our business, you know, in the affordable housing business is obviously preserving existing affordable housing, but we have to figure out ways, innovative ways of adding supply. And so with our property in Detroit, I mean, in a way, it's a public-private venture where we're building on city land where it makes the economics more favorable. And so we're increasingly looking at those opportunities to add to the supply, generally in structures that help the economics. I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, and particularly in California and New York, you know, I'm on the board of one of the very large nonprofits, which does an amazing job, and that's Bridge Housing, which is based in San Francisco. But, you know, a new development, even an affordable development, is over 700,000 a unit. And it's just hard to do that without a lot of public subsidy.
Sure. Yeah. No, and that's the reason why. I mean, it's often said you can't develop a C-grade property or even a B-grade. You know, generally when you're building something, you know, it's just the cost, right?
So the 2x4 doesn't know whether it's going into luxury or affordable.
There you go. Right, exactly. So you're right. The only way to drive that cost down is subsidies or cheap land basis or something, you know, in order to get that down. So that makes perfectly good sense. I do want to mention this. We're about 10 minutes past the time that I generally open up the room for questions from the audience. So if you guys want to start putting those in the chat, we'll start entertaining those questions at this time. But while we're waiting for those to come in, I did want to talk to you also about the opportunity zones. I'm assuming a lot of your projects would be in opportunity zones simply because of the nature of where they are and where opportunity zones are. So has that been a great benefit to you, or how is that all playing out right now?
Well, our Detroit property is in an opportunity zone, so that has been helpful. And, you know, you're right. I mean, we were in opportunity zones before they were opportunity zones.
Yeah.
And I really believe it's a good program. And I think that I actually have developed a friendship with Senator Tim Scott, who was sort of the architect of that. And I think that there are a few enhancements that might be made that would make it more viable, particularly in underserved communities. For instance, the 100% basis, if that could be 50% basis in adaptive rehab, I think that would be better. But I think it's been a good program, and it certainly attracted additional institutional capital. So yeah, I'm positive on it. And I think, though, that the jury is still out to look back. I mean, it will require probably in the next 5 to 7 years looking back to find out if it was successful, but I believe it will be.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point. I think it's interesting. One good thing is that you're able to drive down those yields that a lot of individuals are looking at, because, you know, and when I say individuals, I mean investors, because generally if you're holding that deal for over 10 years, you're not going to be at a 20 IRR or 30% IRR in a lot of cases. So, you know, it opens up the door for more investment for ones that are willing to take a lower return. But we'll see how it plays out. There's still some time to go on that. And then we'll see what it works out. I did want to ask you also about, you mentioned about not over-leveraging properties, and especially being true in affordable housing. Can you elaborate a little bit on that for us as to why over-leverage is, and, you know, obviously there's a lot of economic factors there, but let me let you tell the story as to why you wouldn't want to over-leverage a affordable project.
Well, you know, leverage is just one of those factors. I mean, what I have learned in raising institutional capital, you don't want to be where there's a check the box situation. For instance, like being a registered investment advisor, some investors want to see that in funds they invest, that the sponsor is a registered investment advisor. It's a pain. It's not mandatory. But we became registered and as an SEC advisor and all the others because we didn't want to be eliminated by simply that. And I think that in the institutional world, particularly as we started going and venturing outside the U.S., a lot of investors just like low leverage. And we've been able to generate the returns even with low leverage. And low leverage becomes also, you know, which we haven't talked about, but building an enterprise that has sustainability, our debt service coverage is probably 3 to 1. So if there's a downturn and our cash flows diminish, we're still going to be able to pay debt. But, you know, building companies to be sustainable to me is important. And it's one of the things that as companies of color, that the sustainability is important, building the back room, building the risk management, all those things, that those are the things that I think we need to do to be able to really build larger companies, is to focus on those things that are not as glamorous as doing the deals or making the acquisitions, but it's reporting, the technology, and we've invested, you know, a lot in our technology platform. And that's those things, along with the investment thesis that and low leverage. There are more investors that like low leverage than higher leverage.
Yeah. Well, what would you consider low leverage? Below 60, below 50?
Well, we've launched an open-ended fund. We're limited to 50 on that.
Okay.
And so I think of low leverage being under 50, 50 or below.
Okay. All right. Which means
I used to think of it as 60 and below until I started talking to European investors, and they prefer 30 to 40. So 50 is a stretch for them.
Wow. Okay. All right. That's interesting. But you bring up the point of building an enterprise, and I certainly wanted to go into that as, you know, we're down to about 15 minutes here. You know, that kind of goes toward what do you see as the future at Vantiv? I don't think you're necessarily looking to start another company at this point in your career, but what would you like to see as the future of your company as it relates to, you know, where you're trying to drive this ship?
Well, you know, we believe that, I mean, the fascinating thing about the affordable sector is that the top 50 companies in a universe of about 12 million apartment units, the top 50 owners own about 8% of the space. So it's highly fragmented.
Okay.
So we believe, you know, we're at, call it 16, 17,000 apartments that we own and operate today, that we could double that in the next 5 to 7 years to be 30 to 40,000, somewhere in there. So, I mean, we have a very ambitious growth approach, and we think, and why grow? Part of growth is you attract better people. You start realizing operating economies of scale and, you know, things like that that make you more profitable. And certainly I look at growth, and one of the challenges, if you grow, if we started, say, doing retail centers, you know, I'm starting over building my fixed costs in that. So, you know, right. Once we've established and we've built this platform, to add more to that is really important. And there's a lot of focus on, I spend a lot of my focus on our operating platform, and particularly people, organization. Do we have the right people in the right places? Do we organize efficiently? How do we make decisions? You know, what things can we use technology to make us more efficient? Do we have too many, you know, what is our cycle time for things? And I think about that because that is the essence of building business, getting more efficient in that side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, it's interesting. One of my buddies actually owns a very, very successful mortgage company out in Sacramento. And I remember talking with him, and we were doing lunch out there. And, you know, he said, really, running a business is boring. You know, it's not the doing of the deals per se.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's the nuts and bolts that really hold the company together. And that stuff is just system after system after system that has to be tight and more efficient over time that really helps you build an enterprise, if you will. Yes. So it looks like you've mastered that in two different ways, you know, with Capri and with Vantiv.
Well, I'm not sure you ever master it, but you have to stay focused on it. And the great thing is some of the innovations that are out there. I mean, I spend a lot of time looking at the prop tech companies that are coming and doing enhancements. You know, there are just some great products out there that we try, and probably the best one, and I'm going to give a little shout out to, there's a company called Isuzu that does data analytics, that does reporting to credit agencies, but they have an affiliation now with Fannie. And what they do is they report rental credit history to the agencies that are, you know, the Equifax and the like. Mm-hmm. And so the amazing thing is we've adopted their data analytics at probably 2,000 of our properties. And, you know, and I didn't know it, but, you know, we had probably 200 residents that had no credit history, they were credit ghosts. And now they have a credit score. And more importantly, you know, our average credit score increase of our residents has been about 60 points, which is meaningful.
Mm.
So there are a lot of things we look at in making investments in making our residents be stronger financially. That's a benefit to us. That's part of the enterprise, is looking at ways you can use technology and things that are out there to make you more efficient.
Right. And I actually love that you mentioned that, because really, you know, I'm sure the business model is not to have people hostage in an apartment the rest of their life.
No,
you know,
no.
Yeah. So if you're able to help them by establishing themselves with credit and move on to home ownership at some point, that's a big advantage.
Absolutely. You know?
But they're not locked in poverty for the rest of their life. So, Yeah, I appreciate you doing that and mentioning that. That's huge. Let me ask you one other thing as we discuss this. You know, you talk about using technology, and it's very important. I'm a big tech guy as well. But you have to bridge that gap between the actual technology and using it in the field. And how do you actually do that and bridge that gap between your asset management and the technology? Because obviously, to have that many units, you have some methodology of asset management that's working well. You know, what's the secret sauce?
Well, we continue to try to improve that. And and one of the things is that, you know, you always have to be leery of things that you just say, hey, let's try this or let's do this this way, and getting people to buy in. And so one of the things that, you know, I spend a lot of time visiting our communities, and particularly I will, you know, like we've adopted some new systems for maintenance, for our maintenance techs. So, you know, I'll go and I'll, you know, take a few of them to lunch and like, hey, how is this working? And I hit the real story and they tell me,
right.
You know, and like, okay, we got, and so sometimes the senior folks, they'll say, oh, this is doing well. I said, no. I said, what I learned is they use it, but then they do the old system to make sure that it works.
That it works.
And so, so now you're doing it twice. And so, you know, it's a lot of training. I mean, one of the things the things change very rapidly. And so, you know, we have a VP of training that does across our portfolio training of different, you know, operational procedures. We have something that we called a Vanath University where everybody can plug in. And if you want to learn our big, you know, we use this system called HappyCo, which does property inspections, and it helps on maintenance requests. We have training modules within that. But, you know, getting the adoption of technology, it's just one of those things that you have to do a lot of training, and you have to make people buy into the fact that it's going to maybe short-term issues, but it's going to make their job better in the long run. And you stay at it and recognize that sometimes it doesn't work as well either. So, you know, you have to be empathetic and recognize. I mean, you know, there's certain things that we do understand that, you know, a rental office in a typical community is very busy, and our managers, our maintenance techs, they have very full jobs, and trying to figure out ways we can ease the burden is always something that we're focused on.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking of our own situation. We upgraded our phone system this year or late last year. And man, I can see why I didn't do that for so many years, because it's just like, oh my God, there's so many things you got to adapt to and get the team up to speed with and everything else. So it's certainly a challenge. Want to wrap up with one very serious point that is really the focus of this show. And that's always advice and recommendations to the next generation. You know, we're trying to encourage, obviously, that next generation of young folks to grab on to commercial real estate and grow careers in that space. And we didn't mention this, but you've done an exceptional job. For y'all who don't know, Daryl is part of the Multifamily Hall of Fame. So if anybody knows what they're doing, Daryl knows what he's doing. So we certainly want to give you kudos for that. So what advice would you have? And I want to address that, and also access to capital. That always seems like that is the biggest issue for anybody trying to get going in this space. What would you say as it relates to access to capital and just overall advice for those that are listening that might want to, you know, be the next generation of Daryl Carter's coming along?
Well, I hope they will far exceed that. But I would say this, I mean, and it's really the access to capital, and to me, the most important part of this business and growing in this business are relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And their relationships, you know, I started in banking, and it was just by chance, you know, there was a peer group that I had that, in, you know, and one went on to be the CEO of Equity Residential. One went to be the CEO of Mercadia. One, you know, and so these are people I started in the training program with when I was in my early 20s. And relationships are really, really matter. And they come in all shapes and sizes. And those relationships create opportunities. And certainly amongst, you know, other developers, investors of color. I mean, Victor McFarlane, who's one of my best friends. Victor, you know, we're involved in the redevelopment of the one of the largest, was the largest African-American cooperative that was built in the 70s in San Francisco that comprises four blocks just west of City Hall. And and so our friendship, we're always comparing notes. Hey, do you hear about this? You know, we help each other. But relationships are so important. And it's amazing how, you know, people kind of, they disappear and then they show up somewhere and it may be somewhere of prominence. But I would say my life has been and career has been blessed by the relationships that I have. And certainly you're one of those relationships that I've been blessed by. And I think that to me is the most important part and my best advice to anyone.
Wow. Well, thank you, Dow. That was very kind words. I appreciate that. You know, you're so true. We're working on a development deal here in Atlanta. And, you know, the guy is, I'll say it, he's Egyptian, you know, and so he has a certain mindset and a certain way of doing things. And it's amazing because, you know, he's beating us up about this and beating us up about that. But then I said, look, you know what? I know the presidents or top executives of multiple banks here in Atlanta. Let me make some phone calls to my buddies and see if I can get something done that the average person can't get done. And that changed the whole conversation. But I only know these people because of what you were just saying. You know, when they were quote unquote nobodies, we were still cool. And that was still cool, right?
Yes.
So that's what happens over time, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one thing. The other thing is just, you know, many of the innovations in this company are from some of my younger colleagues who have the ideas. I mean, we created a resident app, and I didn't think that people in affordable housing would adopt technology. I didn't have that instinct, but one of my younger team members had that, and we've really, it's taken off. So wow. Also, don't, you know, surround yourself with people who are different and think differently than you because it's helpful.
Yeah. Well, that goes back to the whole diversity initiative that we have floating around the country. So that's a big thing. And lastly, have you really seen a lot of that capital get dispersed? Because you brought that up. I wasn't even going to talk about this today, but you know what happened with Rodney King? And then there was so many, you know, programs and other things that were initiated. Is that capital actually flowing from what you've been seeing? Or
well, it did in the 90s. Did in the 90s far more than what I've seen now. There have been a lot of promises made. And I think that many of the institutions, you know, made the promises without figuring out how to execute it. And the other thing that has been a little bit troubling to me is that you have a number of large companies, one in particular, that said, we want to invest in companies of color. And then they partner with one of their, you know, customers that is not a minority firm that has very little diversity to do the execution.
Yeah.
So, I think that certainly the talk has been good, but then the intentionality of actually how it's done and putting meaningful dollars out there is something that we have not yet seen. I mean, certainly none of that has flown to us, but, you know, what I'm more concerned about are that next generation of people that I think there are some talented young African-American developers that are on the way up. And I think there is a capital need there. And some of which we partner with other organizations and, you know, we've done that ourselves. Because it makes great business sense.
Yeah. Well, very good point. I appreciate that, Daryl. Well, I tell you what, we're up against the clock. I always try to keep to my commitments on time. Any final comments you have for us and our audience today? This was a very, very mentally stimulating conversation, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But anything you'd like to add as
well? Well, I just like to thank you, and I think that you're, you know, some of these conversations you're having are the right conversations, and we have to keep having them. And I commend you on the success of your career and these podcasts, but I've found them to be very interesting. So keep on doing it, my brother.
Okay. All right, man. I certainly appreciate it and look forward to seeing you out in California in a few weeks. It should be exciting as well. So for all of you today, we want to thank you very much for being here with myself and Daryl Carter. Exceptional conversation, and you're always welcome at the Mornings with Joel CRE podcast. Thank you very much, and goodbye for now. Thank you, Daryl. We really appreciate you.
All right. Have a great day.